Will Ukraine manage to stay in the headlines if all the reporters leave and the supply of human interest stories dries up? Will the EU find the courage to block Russian oil and gas imports at the Council of Europe meeting later this week? And will they eventually invite Boris Johnson? Is Scottish politics stuck in a constitutional impasse? And is every party finding difficulty getting local candidates for the local elections? And will Shell now revive its interest in drilling for oil in the Cambo oil field? Those are the headlines. Now for the podcast.
Hi, Choms, and welcome to this week's Leslie Berrigan podcast. Spring is in the air. There's a spring in my step, and I'm hesitant about saying spring has sprung, the grass is riz. I wonder where the birdies is, because that was the usual one. But it's a smashing day, and it's spring, I think, I hope.
Yep, it feels that way, absolutely. My grandmother that lived in Wick used to have this thing in her council house that she changed her curtains and her the covers on her sofa when she thought spring had arrived. You know, they sort of gone into summer. So it's a bit, and then I don't know if everybody else had the same, but we used to have these horrible, actually brushed cotton, whatever it was, the warm sheets for winter. And then you got into the cotton sheets as soon as it sort of looked like you were, I don't know that you would say we were totally out of that yet, because it's still a bit cold at night. But I quite like these little ritual things. I've got a lot of them in the house myself. You know, I just change things around when I think it feels like we're there. And I changed them all yesterday. So, yep, to me, that's where we're out there.
Well, the big deal in this household is that and the annual debate between Mr. and Mrs. Joyce about when it is time to take the winter duvet out and replace it with the summer lighter duvet. And I err on, let's leave it on for a wee bit longer, because I do recall actually coming out of a Good Friday service and there'd been a blizzard in Lochee. I mean, so it's still there. But yes, the other thing, because I forgot to mention it last week, and in all the heady excitement of being back, it was our 700th episode last week. Well, the 700th episode of the Leslie Riddick podcast, which dates back to Leslie
2007. I know, I had to check it with you beforehand, because I do actually know that. But I was just saying, it's the same way as sometimes where you look at kids and think, hang on a minute, can you really be 15 years old? You know, but so that is 15 years of doing a podcast, first with Chris and then with yourself. So, yep, that was 700 last year, and we forgot to go whoop whoop. So it's 701. Whoop whoop.
it's terrifying. It really is. And the funny thing about it is that when you look back at those early podcasts and the themes that were being investigated and explored at that point, do you feel we're stuck in a kind of a time warp, particularly at this juncture, in terms of politics in Scotland and the potential for another independence referendum and Scottish independence, which is our raison d'etre?
Gosh, you do start with the wee ones, don't you? Well, obviously things have changed in that, you know, in 2007, you know, we'd just got a Scottish. In fact, the first ever episode, was it not, was Alex Salmond from, I seem to remember, from a sort of hot box. You know, this is back to those technologies, in a car park somewhere in Aberdeen, standing doing the full half hour of it. And that was just the very beginning of the SNP in as a minority administration. You know, so back then, and remember, there was still one seat whose name, and this says something, a Labour MSP who was still contesting that he'd been beaten because he just couldn't believe it. And there was just that slender majority. That made them the largest party, but not a working majority. So, I mean, there was an awful lot of denial around where people just went, no, that can't be it. And, you know, let's just do the numbers again. No, that can't be it. Total denial, really, from Labour. And then the whole firmament of all the kind of, you know, Scottish establishment that had formed around an expectation that Labour would be in with the Brits till the end of time. And, so just in that moment, there was a kind of crack in the sort of tectonics. But it did obviously take working through 2007 till 2011 then for, you know, a majority SNP government. Then that gives you the chance for an independence referendum. And again, I mean, I can remember in 2011, yes, there was that majority, which again came as a surprise. I can remember doing many, you know, beard pulling epics in the kind of run up to the election where everybody was totally convinced this was a wee blip and business as usual with Labour in charge would be restored almost immediately at that election. And it didn't happen. So people were just digesting that when, you know, the corollary to it, which was that there would be an independence referendum, so it began to come to the fore and then slowly got organised. So, you know, and then, of course, you don't need me to go through the whole nine yards of the independence referendum, but then out the other side with then just these series of, because we lost that referendum and emboldened David Cameron decided to sort of clean up all the unfinished business of the Tory party. And then, of course, we got Brexit because that was a major miscalculation. That sucked a lot of oxygen from the air, needed a change in the case for independence. Then, of course, there was a change at the top of the SNP, a more cautious but perhaps more in the independence referendum itself, sometimes a more powerful advocate on television, at least, Nicola Sturgeon. And then we've worked our whole long way through that and the, you know, attempted resurgence of Alex Salmond with Alibi, the divisions that's created, the COVID. I mean, there's a piece in today's National that's done by Ben Ray, who's doing a series of things about how all the big events of the last 10 years have affected independence. And I mean, I it's a funny thing when you see yourself quoted in exactly the rambling way that you spoke, which is a testimony to his accuracy and shorthand. But it is one of these things where there has not been a year where there hasn't been a seismic shift in something. Yeah. It's just been unbelievable. And so, of course, that takes us through to where we are now. So we're not in the same place as we were in 2007. Is again a long, you know, long answer. Of course we're not, because there was nobody, you know, nobody but the hardcore of the SNP was thinking about independence in 2007. They just weren't. Everyone was still recovering from essentially the end of the Labour fiefdom. And so there's been an extraordinary amount of unravelling. Just take 15 years. It's been an extraordinary amount of unravelling from very deeply held expectations about what was normal. And now we're sitting in this kind of, it is definitely a kind of uneasy place. Douglas Ross was battering away about the kind of stuckness of Scottish politics, and suggesting that Nicola Sturgeon was, you know, tired and kind of looked uneasy and kind of unsettled. But particularly whether however she's feeling, and dear knows, you know, whatever you think of any politician, you just do wonder where people find the energy sometimes to kind of keep going. But anyway, you know, it's unquestionably the case that we're stuck because the SNP is sitting in a pretty corporatist, middle of the road, kind of very centralised decision making mode. And that's developed over this period under Nicola Sturgeon's leadership. It isn't really challenged. And that's the point. When you start to look at, you know, the opposition that we've got, it really is pretty shambolic. I mean, a lot of the things people might feel are very stuck about Scotland have actually been bolstered by the Tories. And if you looked at that, just that one thing about council tax, and here's how all the pigeons come home to roost. If Rishi Sunak goes ahead with his plans for how he's supposed to help people get over the energy price crisis, part of it will be a bung through council tax. Now, council tax is the most regressive tax that there is, pretty much. And the very poorest pay proportionately more than the richest, which is why in 2007, going back to that, there was a commitment from that new government, SNP government, to overhaul council tax. And just like the commitment, although, you know, there was an Indy ref, of course, but like the commitment now that keeps getting bumped on year after year for Indy ref too, the commitment to reform council tax has just kept getting kicked into the long grass. The most famous example of that being in 2018, when Andy Whiteman, then in the Greens, put forward a package of stuff, which included a land tax as one of the components and moving away from just solely a property tax. And that was the Labour Party. Scottish Labour actually supported him, but the Scottish Tories voted with the SNP against it. And I'm sure, you know, the SNP at the time said, oh, you know, we need a proper, more thought out. What? Yeah, fine, fine.
Yeah.
So here we are. We still haven't touched it. This is 2022. That was 2007. That's 15 years of not tackling something that everyone agrees is the most regressive tax. And we could have done it. So now, every time that you have to use it as the benchmark to, or the bench to lean on for the supply of new forms of support, like that energy one, you're leaning on a wonky fence you could have fixed. And of course, the same goes for land and all the other things that don't get touched. And meanwhile, Labour, I was quite speechless with amazement, actually, at Anna Sarwar advocating that Labour councils shouldn't be doing any kind of deals with other parties after the local elections, partly because they're already in eight deals with other parties, six of which are with the SNP, and these seem to be working really quite well. The one that's causing them problems is in Aberdeen, where they've had a deal with the Tories. Nine councillors were banned from the Labour Party as a result of that. And Anna Sarwar was one of those who voted to readmit them last year. So there's one kind of like what, but the biggest what is that it was a Labour First Minister, Jack McConnell, who introduced STV in local elections, which is a guarantee that you will produce coalitions. I mean, that's what it was trying to achieve. Now, if you're Labour, you could own that. And you could own it completely and argue in a big thinking way that this is an attempt to move towards a different, more modern kind of cooperative local democracy. But of course, then you get into the problem of saying that actually it's the contrast with Westminster because, you know, it still got first past the post, unbelievably, for local elections. And then that looks like a hostage to fortune. Here we go back to the beginning again, folks, on the national question. So
yes.
It's like you cannot go anywhere near a subject that takes you near that problem. And that means Labour cannot outflank the SNP on the left in policy terms because you ain't got room for manoeuvre over there. You've got a big brick wall. You've got a big set of powers you just will never, ever call for being repatriated to Scotland. So you can't go over there because that's problematic and it reignites that whole difficult debate, which is sitting festering within the Labour Party. And there you go, folks. You know, I'm not really going to give a lot of energy to Lib Dem positions. And the Greens have, you know, the Greens are currently sitting in the oxters of the SNP. So we will not get political realignment until we have NDREF 2.
Yeah.
Whichever way it goes,
exactly.
It clears stuff up or down. And they all know that. And shame on the unionists for then trying to complain about the stuckness of Scottish politics and at the same time denying the thing that's not just democratically there, but is the only way we're going to unstick this.
Yeah, because as you noted, Leslie, the Labour Party is struggling to even get candidates. And a leaked memo, an email went out, says you don't need to do anything additional other than put your name forward. You know, no canvassing, no knocking on doors, no actually doing anything or even standing up for any policy development. And the focus, as you rightly said, is every election that takes place in Scotland now is a de facto referendum because they say every vote counts. Labour's got to be second or third. We've got to get in that position. So it's again been perceived through the prism of independence. And they're turning around and actually saying exactly what the Tories are saying, no to independence, no to the SNP. And good governance at local level, well, that to hang with that. It doesn't really count because that is hanging over everything that happens in Scotland is the question of the constitutional question. And there's been some really, really strange things going on. And as you described them, motley crew of candidates that are coming forward, both for Labour and the Conservatives, you know, ex-UKIPers for the Tories and the flirting, which has gone on before the Labour Party, with a former, what was it, the Imperial Grand Master of the Orange Lodge, Henry Dunbar. Not the first. Nor the last significant member of the Orange Order to be a Labour Party candidate. And apparently he's expressed this Henry Dunbar horror and outrage at any form of prejudice or hate. Well, that'll come as news to anyone who's actually ever witnessed an Orange Order march and knows what they actually stand for. But I like everybody out there decide for themselves whether they feel that the Labour Party is adhering to what one presumed to be its stance on fairness and equity in a just society by selecting and continue to select significant members of the Orange Order as candidates for the council elections.
I mean, it is that was the line at the start of the article, the motley crew on both sides. Yeah. And the important point and what you were quoting there from that email was Labour's aim, to get every vote counts. It could be the difference between Labour coming third or second nationally. That's the point, the nationally. So that is these elections, they just don't matter in themselves, at least that email. And let's be fair, that was an email sent from Aberdeen for the Aberdeenshire branch. So it's not a kind of like, a round robin for the entire of Scotland. But, having spoken to a few Labour folk, it is pretty grim. You know, that there's just not a lot of people coming forward. But actually, there's not a stampede for the SNP either. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's generally speaking and I think, eventually you come back to, and I feel like I will be muttering this in the grave, is that really, if you look back at the kind of IndyRef, power is an aphrodisiac. It makes you want to get involved. It's the reason that, all the kind of young folk got so woken up, in the 24 referendum, because there was a moment of possible major change and the power was in the hands of the Scottish people. Now, when you look at what a vote in a council election represents to you meaningfully, it's very hard to see what that is. The local councils get pretty much all their income from the Scottish government, whilst just, for example, in Sweden, it's entirely the other way around. All the money comes directly, all income tax goes directly to your local council. And by gum, does that ever promote turnout? They've got your money. So the Swedes have 92% turnout in local elections, allied to which they have truly local councils, which sort of cohere with what you think is the place you live in. Now, I mean, OK, I do live in Fife. We both live in Fife.
Yeah.
But that's, that's not what I think of as my local area.
No.
I mean, it's a kingdom, ain't it? So it's enormous. It's 187,000 people, actually. And once again, to batter on, the average size of a council in the EU is 10,000 people. 187,000, 10,000. So, I mean, I noticed a tweet this morning which was asking whether Scandinavian countries and others have elected mayors or directly elected provosts. I mean, honest to, that's not the important question. No. What they have is truly local councils. I mean, even after doing all sorts of mergers, there are 356 councils in Norway, same population as Scotland, 32. So, if you were looking at this and feeling you want to really do something for your local area, and that feeling is so strong in Scotland, it's not absent. It just has nothing in a sort of structural way to connect with. What it connects with is food banks. It's local, truly local community efforts. It's often community buyouts to run assets that the distant council wants to close. So at the moment, the urge is exactly the same in Scotland as it is anywhere else, but it's not scooped up by formal politics. And the councils sit loveless and distant. And I've got to say, it's not much of a gig to be a councillor, because you're just there to take it in the neck, because basically nobody knows you, and I don't know if I actually know a single councillor, whereas I kind of actually bizarrely know councillors from other countries because they're activists. But I know activists, they would never dream of being councillors. So there's the problem for all the parties. And, we can have the point scoring that inevitably characterises our politics, where everyone goes, oh, look at Labour, they can't manage to get any decent candidates. And, well, thankfully, I would hope there aren't too many, Ku Klux Klan supporting kind of candidates in the SNP. But right, if that's one thing that could attract your attention, as ever, the thing that really doesn't bother people very much is the massive structural problem that sits beneath it that nobody really wants to look at. I mean, it's like today, sorry, I'm on this now.
No,
looking at, I can't mind what it was it the National or the Herald or whatever? And there's, you know, there's all the stories that we'll come onto doubtless about oil and what level of sanctions should be next for Ukraine and Russia and so on. And just there's a tiny little piece in there about a new report from some British academics who are experts in the field of climate change, saying that basically the developed nations have to stop using and producing any fossil oil and gas by 2034. Mm-hmm. And that is to let the developing world, who didn't create the emissions, have till 2050 to completely stop.
Yeah.
So here we are, complete stop 2034 with guys who sit and worked, modelled it all through. It's got no comments.
No.
Because and that's so let's you've got to frame it like this, because sure, we'll doubtless come on to talking about Shell thinking that it might start up Cambo again. You know, a lot of people thinking, yeah, you know, feeling rattled and yeah, let's just get crank the wheel. I mean, God, this is a, you know, we're just about to see a real epic, and there certainly is a terrible situation. But other countries have made calmer, better decisions in the midst, in the, you know, the eye of the storm.
Yeah.
And that's what this is. But the interest levels in the story that, you know, is the one, it's probably because we already know this. How do you actually manage to force some vigor and vibrancy and whatever through the big, you know, the big stories, the big ones that don't have a sort of flamboyant character on them, that don't involve a snub to someone, that don't involve, you know, directly Boris Johnson's face. I mean, you know, if you become hooked on that as the means by which you negotiate the world, then the big elephants in the room, you walk right past them.
Well, yeah, that's because what it is, we're living in a clickbait news world where, oh, look at Boris Johnson fat running along the beach and then doing a silly jump. Click, 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 click. Well, that's really, yeah, we'll go in there and we'll talk about that. And the other piece of news, which is that the horrifying news about the unprecedented rise in simultaneous rise in temperatures of both the Arctic and the Antarctic simultaneously. I mean, this is, if there was ever a clear and obvious warning that we really have to get this moving really, really quickly, and do not allow the crisis in Ukraine and the energy crisis there to drive us back towards fossil fuels as the solution. You know, if there was ever a clear warning, that should be it. But as you said, it's not
easy. I mean, I'll grant everybody that trying to kind of kick any habit, every you know, transition that there is, whether it's been from an energy use mode or a constitutional change in independence, whatever, you know, these just don't really generally happen very smoothly. That doesn't mean to say they're not wise to consider. Mm-hmm. And it does make you wonder what politicians then think of their electorate. And if you've got the electorate in a you got in because you lied to them and you got away with it mode, and if you're in a you are a serial liar, you've been found out, you nearly lost your job, but you just managed to hang on because something even bigger happened mode, then what is your incentive to try to talk, you know, really honestly to your electorate when it comes to making big, big decisions like this? And just on that question, just to juke it to the side of a minute on that business of the clickbait. I mean, there's a horrific tag running this morning on Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe, send her back as a hashtag.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, it's, you know, it hardly needs saying, this is just appalling. I mean, that she had the, you know, this is the line of it is that 400 million was spent to get her back. And she basically has been ungrateful by pointing out that she was stuck in jail, much of it solitary confinement, unnecessarily for 6 years.
Yeah.
So the send her back hashtag, that's where that's coming from. But just by the by, when I went in to have a look at it, the bulk of it is people saying that they're horrified by send her back as a hashtag. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, and I sort of swithered for a minute and wondered about whether to say anything. And I thought, but, you know, that actually just gets another turn on that hashtag.
Yeah.
For those who don't use Twitter, you know, that's the thing that just allows you to brand a subject essentially so that people can find it quickly. And by saying that you don't agree with something, you're actually making that you disagree with trend even more strongly. So, I mean, but nonetheless, coming back to the oil thing, it's so patently obvious that the reason that that debt, which was incurred from 1971, mm-hmm. 7 years before Nazanin Zaghari-Ratcliffe was born, that debt was only repaid because we need Iran to turn on the oil switches.
Yeah.
So that's all, you know, that's the only reason that suddenly, you know, there was the fifth or sixth or seventh, you know, foreign secretary suddenly managed to find a resolution to something. And it's like we're being taken for idiots. I mean, who really, I mean, well, obviously some, but I mean, I would have thought in Scotland, really nobody's being taken, you know, for a ride on that one. But the problem does still exist, you know, in a geopolitical sense of what happens if there's more sanctions, which will be discussed at a Council of Europe ministers meeting with Joe Biden on Thursday and Friday in Brussels, to which Boris Johnson mm-hmm. has not yet been invited.
Yeah.
After his comments about, you know, trying to make parallels between Brexit and Ukraine. But anyway, at that meeting, they'll be looking at what bigger sanctions they can place. And there are some still. There's two banks. One is Gazprom Bank, so maybe very related, actually, to the gas industry that in Russia that haven't been removed from the SWIFT system. So there's still things like that that can be done. But the real big one is basically deciding to just block oil imports from Russia and gas. And that's, you know, the worry is that if there's sanctions placed on that, the Russians will just switch the taps off completely. If that happens, then different countries have different levels of major difficulty overnight to deal with. And of course, that's exactly why it was always wise not to put all your eggs in one particularly Russian basket when it came, or indeed fossil fuel basket. You know, a diversified energy policy was always a good idea for all sorts of reasons. But that's what these guys are having to consider, and all the countries within the EU. I mean, interestingly, there's countries like Bulgaria who are actually calling for that, and they're like 90% dependent on Russian oil mm-hmm. and gas. But they've quietly been trying to set up a pipeline to get liquid gas from they're going to Greece, and then they'll get supplies, they think, from other sources that will allow them to basically go cold turkey from Russian supplies. But there we are again. The world is going to be full of tankers running LPG all over the place to compensate at the same time as the Russians try to kind of offload their oil and gas onto the Chinese and India.
The Indians, yeah.
Who will be, you know, and everybody is compromised. Everybody's compromised by their dependence on fossil fuel energy.
Yeah.
And that's where you come back full circle to the Cambo decision. Yep, okay, Shell might be sniffing around that now that, you know, oil has gone much, the price of oil has gone much higher, and the near certainty that new forms of supply will need to be created. But I mean, no one should be under much illusion not to supply us, because 70% of the oil that comes out of the North Sea is already exported.
Yeah.
So, you know, you can, you know what I mean? If we wanted to, if we decided to nationalize, if we'd had a nationalized industry, we would currently not be exporting any of it.
Yeah.
So grand, knock yourselves out, you know, get Cambo going, get everyone feeling relieved because, you know, somewhere in the background, the drug that we've depended on for the last, well, since 1974, is basically, you know, someone's cooking up more of it to sell on the highest, you know, to the highest bidders, mm-hmm. which will probably not be us. And sometime down the line, you know, whereas right now, I'm sorry to keep thumping on about it, but there's the old Severn barrage, 77% of the entire energy use of England could be supplied by that. And actually right now, the Western Isles is waiting still, waiting for a subsea connector that would allow development of a massive field that's been sitting for 15 years waiting to go ahead, a wind farm at Ishkin. And I know because I've just been revising the book, Cycling Up the Western Isles. And as I cycled through it in 2007, that was one hell of a year, actually.
Yes.
Both starting the podcast and cycling all over the place. But as I cycled through that in 2007, they were putting together this really ambitious plan that was going to revolutionize the whole of the Western Isles because of the size of the scale and ambition of it, still waiting for the British government to approve a subsea connector that allows that energy off the island. It'll always be our energy. There is no intervening Shell or anybody else. It's net zero. What's the problem? And why are we not outraged, actually, that this is not going, being escalated and pushed through hyper fast? Because those are the recurrent, those are the forms of energy that we need built in along, as we've said before, with tidal to give us that different baseload. So, yeah, I will stop now.
No. I mean, it's just it was reflecting on that analogy that you drew about in terms of addiction and a dealer, because Russia is the dealer.
Mm.
It is the energy superpower. It's got the largest natural gas reserves, second largest coal reserves, largest oil shale reserves in Europe, leading natural gas exporter, second largest oil exporter, etc. Then we look at its mineral wealth, which is tied, interestingly enough, not just the usual gold and silver, but lots of the elements that are required for the production of electric vehicles.
Mm.
Then we get into the food exports. So we're completely tied into this. And you've got the triple issues of Brexit, COVID, and now Ukraine, which is leading to this cost of living crisis, which is coming roaring at us. And we're in thrall and we're being governed by a Conservative Party who I sense, you know, with Sunak, and we await his spring statement, may revert to the austerity model yet again, and going counterintuitively to what we know from what happened during COVID, and counter to what happened in the 1930s when we came out of the Depression through the New Deal, for example, in the States. They're going to cut and cut and cut again. And what's coming down the line, for example, in national insurance rises, energy rise, costs going up. I mean, it's appalling what's happening, and we're being governed by people who were fundamentally the Britannia Unchanged, the freedom group within the Conservative Party, who are right-wing ideologues. And this is their, again, it's a disaster capitalism. And they will use this to cut and cut again, I think. And Ian, yeah, Blackford was very good on this on the Sunday show with Martin Geisler, where he talked about still austerity, talked about the necessity to invest in new technologies. But that's caught within that framework of, I don't think this government and the UK government will do it.
Indeed. There's talk that this national insurance rise might have the thresholds raised, so that's a way of taking some of the poorest people out of the national insurance rise, which will buy off some of the objections that's coming from even within the Tory party. But it's, you know, there was a statistic that with the expected rises, that actually of tax rises, which is where the this is, if there is austerity, then it's austerity sort of Mark II is a terrible package of both austerity and tax rises at the same time. And it was projecting that by 2026, we would end up, you know, the average tax, you know, the grouping of all the taxes would be about 36%.
Yeah.
Now, you know, this brings you back a little bit, because this is back to the old stealth tax thing, you know, where, in fact, you know, everybody will throw their hands up still in horror, although with great admiration for the Nordic economies, on the basis that they have high personal taxation of 40%. So, you know, and that's basically, you know, that's out there, that's argued for, that's advocated for, and that's explained by the provision of excellent services.
Yes.
So, you'll grudgingly pay it because it's a system that works and it maintains solidarity and all the stuff that, you know, people know goes on. Whereas what we'll end up with here is an incredibly high tax base by, as you say, you know, crisis capitalists who will be far more worried about whether poor old, you know, Rees-Mogg has to shift his money yet again to somewhere else in the EU zone to kind of protect it from himself. In which way, and I'm not trying to draw parallels in any larger sense, it's the same as Putin, despite, you know, his absolute antipathy towards all things Western, educating his children there and keeping his money safe there. You know, there's an extraordinary parallel right at the top where these guys are absolutely saying one thing in a dogmatic way and then in their actions actually safeguarding their own personal interests right outside the chaotic system they've created for themselves.
Yes.
So, yes. You know, it's a Blumenserfecht, and the you know, the better countries don't make headlines enough for you to know where they stand on all of these things. But what they're quietly doing is just providing decent enough services to make everybody want to keep paying taxes to keep their politics in that zone. And that's a sort of virtuous circle, which is just the exact mirror of our unvirtuous circle that is just this constant race to the bottom. So, I mean, it'll be a weary, awful thing to listen to this spring statement any which way you want to look at it. And, you know, just if you were watching the NotMar program, you know, that the contribution by Martin Lewis from Money Saving Expert or whatever was, I mean, he chose very well to make an impact with what he said, not by trying to be Mr. Clever Clogs at all about it, but just by saying, I now despair. Yeah. There's no tricks I can suggest to help you now. This is beyond advice. And that really stuck, actually. I mean, even, you know, with a lot of papers that are still inexplicably massive Tory supporters. So, we're in a really pretty poor place with sort of vision and real leadership pretty absent.
Yeah, well, Dr. Sandesh Gulhani was followed Ian Blackford on that, and Martin Geisler questioned him on the economy, and immediately Gulhani pivoted to apparently Ukrainian soldiers singing "God Save the Queen" as they launched the weapons.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, what? And that was the most glaringly obvious example of someone who's not terribly great communicator pivoting to the line that they're going to be putting out. Scottish independence equals Brexit. Scottish independence equals Russian nationalism. You know, break up the UK. It's as Dr. Jonathan Ayle that said on the front page of the Herald, you know, the Putin would be delighted at another independence referendum if he ever did think about Scotland and the UK. You know, if he does think about that, he would be delighted by it, because at this time of crisis, you know, he wants the West to be, you know, inward looking, navel gazing, etc. And that's what Gulhani went on about, and Geisler could not get him to answer directly a question about economics and the crisis that was coming down the line. It's bereft, Leslie. That's what gets me. And it's so glaringly obvious of this mustering of arguments that you can see. And I know Kenny Farquharson wrote in the Times about having to reconsider Scottish nationalism in the light of, you know, what's going on in Ukraine. And Jerry Hassan's riposte to him, I thought, was absolutely excellent. There's a major assumption that everyone who supports Scottish independence is per se what would be defined as a nationalist. It's just the unfortunate name of the Scottish National Party, which allows a lot of this conflation between the concept of nationalism and the concept of independence to be put together.
Yeah, this is, I mean, you could just as easily, this is why, I mean, I wrote this a couple of weeks, there's no strong parallels here really to be made. It's just a dangerous area where any attempt to sort of try, even I saw there was an SNP MSP try to riposte to that. Putin would be delighted with, we'd be doing Putin's job for him. Look, Putin doesn't give a flying whatever what we do. There's no impact on anybody at all. So don't go there. if they're going to talk this rubbish, I mean, I quite admired Martin Geisler's thing when Gilhani came out with this just, I mean, beyond offensive, utterly ridiculous thing about the God Save the Queen being played by the Ukrainians, and just ignored it and went on, you know, because that's what it's for. It's just a rabbit hole, you know, it's a distraction that's going to pull you off the argument, and he just ignored it. But, you know, you could, if you were going to get into these arguments, nationalism, that sense of a sort of a belief in the national identity of something with borders that you believe you belong to, which has its own way of doing things, its own cultural outlook and its own society sort of values. Yep. I mean, if you were going to say that, then I suppose I am a Scottish nationalist. But, yeah, nationalist, I've never described myself that way. No. It doesn't, you know, we've managed through a whole blinking referendum without ever having to kind of end up defining terms that way. I'm an independent supporter and I constantly couch it that way when I'm asked on anything, which is increasingly rare. But that's because independence is pretty much not a discussion point at the moment.
Yeah.
I'll always make the point that I support Scottish independence. I put it that way. But, you know, just coming back to that, are the Ukrainians nationalists? If you're going to sort of, I mean, it's such a thin and wobbly way to behave in life, is to sort of try to extract value on your in your own position by any sort of connection to what will inevitably be the changing fortunes of others in the headlines. It's just absolute folly, really. The Ukrainians, well, you know, within Ukraine, there's a whole set of stuff. I mean, if you look at the eastern Donbass region, and this sometimes is confusing, but it contains Donetsk and Luhansk. Donbass is a big coal producing area, and during the Second World War, it was occupied by the Germans, who used that to fuel their war machine. They actually forcibly removed lots of the Ukrainians there to become essentially slave labor in other parts of their empire. And the area was massively depopulated. After the war, when partition meant that Ukraine disappeared behind the Iron Curtain, then the Russians moved lots of Russians in to repopulate that area. And so the population changed and has become now, at independence in 1991, roughly 50% ethnic Russian, which is different then to the rest of Ukraine. Well, there's not a complete absence of Russians, but that, you know, that balance is at its strongest within the Donbass region. In the 1990s, at that point, although the Donbass was in favor of Ukrainian independence, they wanted a federal Ukraine. And miners in the Donbass went on strike in 1993 to achieve Russian being included as an official language, a federal Ukraine, and various other things. But those were the two main things. But they still didn't want out of Ukraine. They wanted a federal structure. That basically was denied to them. And you might say that's kind of where we are a bit today, because when it comes to what will happen and the peace talks, if they are genuine on the Russian side, that are going on, much of it pivots on the future of that eastern region, which I'm not sure anyone has actually tested wants to be part of Russia again, or wants to be actual independent. Perhaps they feel, well, they tried to push for a federal solution within the Ukraine and it wasn't forthcoming. Perhaps people now feel, well, whatever, you know, we're off. But and of course, I'm no expert. This is just, you know, the result of a quick morning's Googling through what is a really mixed bag of stuff. And there is also the absolute fact that the Azov movement or battalion, which was formed out of the 2014 war, that absolutely pulverized aspect parts of the Donbass region. They were found to have, by the UN Human Rights Commission, they were found to have committed war atrocities and had raped people. There have been all sorts of stuff happening within the eastern Ukraine. Now that Azov movement, which started pretty informally, was then incorporated into a formal regiment within Ukraine's National Guard. There's horrible stuff said by various of their leaders. Andriy Beletsky said Ukraine's national purpose was to lead white races of the world in a final crusade against Semite-led inferior races. And he was an MP until 2019.
Yeah.
So, you know, for sure, that all happened. However, the kind of party that he led and that represented most of the Azov thinking generally got 2% of the vote across Ukraine.
Yeah.
And obviously, Zelensky is a Jew himself. And actually, much of the perception is that that there was a clear out pretty much of the political representation of these people in 2019, and that they now have very, very little influence within the body politic of Ukraine. But I mean, and actually, when you go right back, you know, every event that you get has got something preceding it,
yeah,
which is important to know. 2014, for example, we'll all probably have got now that was the Russian invasion of Crimea. But why did that happen? In 2014, which, let's face it, we were kind of a bit, you know, busy otherwise at the time. What was happening there was that the then president of Ukraine, Yanukovych, who was pretty much a Russian-supported frontman from the Donbass, the parliament had urged him to sign a free trade agreement with the EU. That's what they wanted. He refused to do that and signed a free trade agreement with Russia. And that's what kicked off the whole kind of the revolution of dignity, as it's translated into English in 2014, in February, when pretty much there was an uprising against him. He fled the country and in his absence was removed as president. But in his absence, a month later, he called on the Russians to support him and to basically usurp what he described as a coup, as illegitimate government. And that's when, on his say-so, because the Russians were still recognizing him as president, despite him having been removed by the Ukrainians, that was the pretext which allowed the Russians to invade Crimea. So that was then the Azov movement formed in response to that.
Yeah.
Not saying anything of this is reasonable. And that, no. You know, you can't sort of, in, you know, there's clearly something in the attitudes of people which can be stoked up easily or doesn't exist. Happily in Scotland, every attempt to whip up some kind of right-wing reactionary violent thing has actually just not worked. But it's a complex situation.
Exactly. So
come back to the beginning again. Are the Ukrainians nationalists? And if so, what nation, you know, which nation do they think they belong to? If you look at all the events they've had, we think we've had eventful lives since 2014. By gum, you know, these people have been through an enormous amount in the struggle to get to a kind of country they could be proud of that's roughly democratic and is working against lots of deeply held convictions and behaviours and divisions which leave them constantly prey to their bigger neighbour coming in sort of pretext, which we know Russia is all too able to do. So it just seems to me, don't go there.
Yeah.
You know, unless you're going to sit and spend time to try and really understand what large object you're trying to, you know, kind of harness your pony to, just go under your own steam. Don't do that.
And no matter what, no one with an ounce of humanity can actually sit back and watch what's going on in Ukraine and say that the window is broken on both sides, to use that well-known Dundee phrase. You know, there is no equivalence, you know, between, you know, there's none at all, because this is a destruction, a wholesale destruction on a scale which we've seen in Syria. Yeah, we're seeing in Yemen as well. They're there. And it is that inhumanity that is going on through from a dictator that is quite prepared to engage in overpowerful force to actually force his will on an independent nation. And no matter of justification about the Azov battalion and its undoubted atrocities and its Nazi ideology can mask that fact. You know, it's just, you know, it's mind-boggling.
And it leaves you, you know, I was having a conversation with a neighbour here yesterday, just in the lovely weather, and both of us just immediately went to how guilty you feel. You know, any lovely thing you realize, you know, anything that you could take for granted, that, you know, the systems that we're using to record this, the electricity that's powering it, the warmth that you feel, you know, not just because of the sun, but even at night when the sun's gone, you know, all the things that are just there. And even, I cycled, I have a big long cycle, first one of the year yesterday, and basically was blooming frozen the whole time. Even if you were sitting still in the shade, in the sun, it was great. But as soon as you're moving at any speed at all, it was absolutely Baltic. So when I came back, it was so cold, I just basically ran a bath and jumped into it and thought, see, you know, even at the moment where I was thinking, God, this is bliss, I just thought, and these guys haven't even got cold water supplies. You know, it's just, it's actually something that maybe, you know, we should look at sometime, and I hope will be looked at in an academic way. Our understanding of war is being completely recast by the level of journalistic input that's going into reporting from Ukraine. There's just not been any other. You can go through the where's and why for, and we did sort of touch on this before. Yes. But the fact that we've still got, I mean, there's an AFP, Agence France Presse grouping that have been in Mariupol and were one of the last lot. They, I think, were taken out yesterday. Well, you know, that they've been supplying through to Politico and various other people, all people in the end will be using press agency information. But as soon as these people disappear, then that just goes quiet. You know, apart from the social media messaging that comes out, which will also go quiet because there's no electricity. Yeah. So, you know, it's like that one about if a tree falls in a forest and it doesn't make if there's nobody there, did it make a sound? Well, if something happens in a place and it doesn't get reported and cannot be characterized with faces and stories and narratives and urgency and all those personalizing things that draw those stories right into your soul, if that stops, will it fall off the news agenda? Yes, it will.
Yeah.
And will we then lose this sense of identification and kind of just, you know, the presence of Ukraine with you all the time? It will go, and it's already going off the headlines.
Yeah, because the whole thing about it is, it's one of the key areas is who decides what is a story and who decides that perspective to be presented from. And it's a story. Ukraine is a story.
It's a story partly because people are able to, if it was a story that was relying on statistics, the numbers of troops, the numbers of tanks, the days of the war, you know, those things, it wouldn't be on a front page. It's on a front page because everybody has got embedded folk over there who are sending human interest stories back and who are also in all the surrounding areas. I mean, look at Poland. You know, people had a lot of worries about, I'm not expert enough in that country, so I won't go into it, but, you know, some of its own politics. They've got 2 million refugees. 2 million. I wouldn't have thought that we have 200 yet. Yeah. But they're gamely coping with that. And it's changed, I would imagine, that whole experience. And again, as everyone will know, not in refugee camps, but in individual households. So, I mean, that's sort of almost Slavic, although, again, I'm doubtful about my ethnic grouping here. But nonetheless, the neighbourliness of those, you know, former Soviet bloc countries dealing with one another is stunning. And in political terms, they're the ones arguing, despite their dependency on Russian supplies, they and the Baltic republics are the ones calling for a complete, ban on oil imports. So they've been hugely sort of emboldened and enlivened and, you know, given an incredible sense of common cause and purpose out of all this by actually having to dig deep and do things. You know, this is a moment that could have come for any of them. And they're not pulling the drawbridge up. They're not doing shameful little rubbish hashtags on anyone who dares criticize a status quo that doesn't work for anybody. They have become the humanitarians of the peace, and we have become the watchers, the cynical, you know, look at our watchers. And the only thing that penetrates these large casts of the opinion that's created by our governments and our generally right-wing media are the human interest stories that just will not let you look away. And when they stop being supplied, Ukraine will disappear.
Yeah. Well, the thing about the Polish experience is, yes, they've opened the doors to 2 million Ukrainian refugees. But key point, they're not Muslims. And that has been made absolutely clear until that stance that they take about refugee status. And it's a pretty rank government in terms of its reactionary policies there. But absolutely, absolutely stepped up to the mark on this. Just on a personal basis, I saw my daughter's son-in-law and the three bairns off on their walk across the bridge on Sunday. And it struck me when I saw what was happening. My son-in-law, Matt, had his four-year-old grandson, Oscar, on his shoulders. Sam was pushing the two-year-old wee one in a buggy. And Frey Rose, 8, was walking across the bridge. And I thought to myself, that's the experience that people are going through in reality in Ukraine. They're walking, carrying kids on shoulders, pushing bairns and buggies, and wee ones walking to get to escape from the destruction that's taken place with this fascist invasion. And the good news is they've raised £3,000 through their efforts to send off to aid refugees. And we've also had the first batch of Dnipro kids arriving in Scotland as well, which is good news.
Just translate that.
Yeah, well, there's I think there's 50 children now being allowed in through the Home Office have allowed 50 kids into Scotland. Ian Blackford was talking about this, that the Scottish government was trying to get out of Ukraine, and they've now been allowed in. And negotiations and discussions are continuing to take place between the Scottish government, the SNP, and the Home Office. And there seems to be a movement taking place there that the barriers are coming down slightly, but still not nearly enough.
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to have a look in about this for for this week's column, because I mean, that it was quite extraordinary that the British government actually seemed to have accepted the Scottish and Welsh government's case to become super sponsors, by which it just means literally you can put Scottish government in as the name of the person in Britain that you're trying to reach.
Yes.
I cannot believe, I don't know how a civil servant actually can hold their head up having produced a system like this.
Yes.
I've thought that would haunt you for the rest of your life, that you know you've just produced something that's guaranteed to not be usable. But still, you know, the UK government hasn't listened to any concession pleas over COVID, Brexit, you name it, from the devolved administrations. So it's very strange that they've suddenly seems to have accepted this one. Whether it's just that it'll now get wrapped up in more red tape, I don't know. But I do know that the Positive Action for in Housing, PAIH, which is run by the redoubtable Rubina Qureshi, it has a long-running scheme, Rooms for Refugees, which has been, I think, the longest-running organisation supporting all refugees in Europe. Now, they have just got a system which they are saying that folk in Ukraine have found at the other end, and they do very careful matching of people, because that's again what the British just, you know, it's just kind of widgets in, widgets out as far as the Foreign Office is concerned. But the difficulty for them is that they're now being overwhelmed so much by people, members of the public, calling to try to kind of understand how the whole thing could work.
Yeah.
They can't get on with the actual business. And yet I suspect in any case, their efforts are thwarted by the Home Office, you know, kind of regulations. So I need to try and get that a bit straighter and talk to Rubina and see what's going on. So, yeah, it's pathetic.
Yeah, but fingers crossed that things are actually moving in a more positive direction. I mean, and being the optimist that I am, I just sincerely hope that there are rays of light in terms of our response taking in refugees and getting them to the UK and Scotland in order to reach safety. And as we hit the 701st episode as well. It was March the 17th, St. Patrick's Day, and was the launch in 2021 of the subscription service. And we, again, just like to reiterate our thanks to everyone who subscribed in the past year. You've enabled us to go out and do all sorts of interesting things and interview all sorts of interesting people, such as Dr. Philippa Whitford. We've done the Preston model, etc. And it's been a real pleasure to be able to do that. And note, though, just to say that, folks, if you are having difficulty in resubscribing, that please get in touch with us, because I know from things that I've done in the past, and I've had to do it in the past couple of weeks, my credit card has, or my debit card has gone out of date, the one that I entered into to various sites that I subscribe to. So if that happens, please contact us, folks, and we can offer solutions. And if you do decide to cancel, do not panic. The podcast will always and everywhere be free. And that's a key decision that Leslie and I made right at the beginning of the process. But thanks again to everyone who does subscribe. Please get in touch if you do have any issues.
Well said, that man, who is indeed the man who fixes all the pernickety technical stuff, which my eyes just roll at. So, yes, thank you, Pat, for always fixing it.
That short news that I'm the technical expert in this partnership. We'll see you next week, Jones.